Tesamadala from the beginning of the final parak. So the Mishnah says, Isha Shahalach Baila Vitsarasa Limdinas Hayam, Uva Uva Amrula Mes Baalich, Lo Sina Seva Lo Sisyabim, Acheteda Shema Uberes Itsarasa. So the Mishnah says the following. Imagine you have a woman who's married, her husband, and the co-wife, meaning not her, but the other wife, they go overseas, and then someone comes and tells her that your husband died. So now she's kind of stuck as to whether she can either get remarried or do yibum, again, depending on the scenario, whether there are children or not. She needs to first find out if the co-wife that traveled with her husband became pregnant and had a child. That obviously will impact the question of whether she has to do yibum or whether she can get remarried. So the Mishnah says that she really can't do anything until she figures out whether the co-wife had a child. Then the Mishnah says, Then the Mishnah adds an additional factor, which is, let's say at the time that her husband traveled overseas, the assumption was the husband didn't have any brothers, so if in fact he died, even if he died childless, obviously if there are no brothers, then the mitzvah of Yibum or Chalitza obviously does not apply. But the question now is, do we have to be concerned that the mother-in-law maybe had a baby boy at some point, in which case there is going to be a mitzvah of Yibum? So the Mishnah says that the starting point is you don't have to be concerned for that. You don't have to assume that the mother-in-law had a baby. However, if the mother-in-law was pregnant already, so that's a machlokas. According to the Tanakhama, then you have to be concerned. Maybe she had a boy, and now maybe the mitzvah of Yibum will apply. But according to Rabbi Yehoshua, you don't have to be concerned for that. Again, we'll see in the Gemara exactly why that is. Okay, so the Gemara asks, "Mayhi tzarasa hakamash malon lahat tzarahu dechayshinan aval tzara acharidi lo chayshinan." So the implication from the Mishnah is you only have to be concerned that this co-wife that traveled with the husband overseas, maybe she had a baby, and that's going to potentially, you know, get rid of the mitzvah of Yibam. But you don't have to be concerned that, well, maybe the husband married another co-wife, and maybe that other co-wife is pregnant. That already, you don't have to be concerned with. You only have to worry about that one co-wife. Then the Mishnah said, Lo sina seva lo sis yabim. Bishlama yabume lo, de dilma miabra vikapaga be eshesach de oraisa. Ela lo sina seyamai. Halecha harov nashim, verov nashim misabro siyoldo. So the Gemara asks as follows. I understand why the woman in this scenario can't do Yibum until she figures out whether the co-wife had a child, because maybe if the co-wife did in fact have a child and she goes ahead and does Yibum, that's obviously an Isser de Oraisa of Eish Asach. You can't do Yibum when there are children involved. But the question is, why can't she just get married to somebody else? Why would you think that she should be allowed to? Because we should follow the Rove. The Rove is that most women become pregnant and have a child, and if that's the case, then obviously there's no mitzvah of Yibum, and if there's no mitzvah of Yibum or Chalitza, she should be free to marry whoever she wants. In other words, why don't we just rely on the Rove? So the Gemara says, well, maybe not. Lema Rabbi Meir hi dechayish lemiyuta. So perhaps the fact that our Mishnah is insisting that this woman is not allowed to get remarried, in other words, that she can't just do Yibum or get remarried, maybe this is reflecting the opinion of Rabbi Meir, because Rabbi Meir happens to be the one throughout Shas who's concerned for the miut. He's the one who's always worried about that minority possibility. Well, that maybe the woman did not have a child. Maybe the woman had a miscarriage. Maybe the woman, you know, again, maybe she didn't have a baby. In which case, if that were true, then obviously the woman would still be obligated to do Yibum. So the Gemara says, no, it's not true. Afilu tema rabbanan ki azle rabbanan basa ruba de ise kaman ki gotesha chaniyos esanhedri avo ruba de leise kaman lo azle rabbanan basa ruba. The Gemara says you can even argue that our Mishnah can reflect the opinion of the rabbanan, even though the rabbanan generally follow the rove. That's only true by what's called the ruba de ise kaman. Ruba de ise kaman means that the rove is in front of me. I can count it. I can point to it. So, for example, the famous case that appears in Maseches Chulin, the case of tesha chaniyos. Right, I have 10 stores. 9 of them sell kosher meat. 1 of them sells non-kosher meat. And I find a piece of unmarked meat outside of the stores, so the assumption is I can assume that that piece of meat is kosher based on the rove. That's just a counting rove. I count up the stores. There's a 90% chance that the meat is kosher, so that's fine. So then the Rabbanan say you follow the rove. Or similarly, the Gemara says, by the case of a Sanhedrin, we know that the din is, let's say we know for din and a fushas, or capital cases, so the Mishnah tells us in Masechah Sanhedrin that you need to have a bezin of 23 to adjudicate capital cases. So let's say you had 12 of the dayanim said the guy was innocent and 11 said guilty, so you follow the rove and you say the guy is innocent. That's the din. So those are cases that are very easy, very simple. You just count it up, and whatever is the majority wins out. But what about what's called a ruba de leise kaman? Ruba de leise kaman is basically another way of saying a statistical rove or a statistical probability. Like, for example, the Gemara says, you know, most animals are not trefos. Most women give birth at 9 months. Those are not roves you can point to or count. Those are more like statistical probabilities. So there, the Gemara says that the Rabbanan maybe do not follow the rove in that case. They only follow the rove by a ruba de isa kaman. So you can even argue that our Mishnah is reflecting the opinion of the Rabbanan, because the idea basically is that you're saying, well, most women become pregnant and give birth. Again, that's not a rule that people counted up all the women in the world. It's just a statistical probability. So the Gemara pushes back. So the Gemara says, hang on one second. How can you suggest that the Rabbanan do not follow the Rov by Aruba Delesa Kaman? In other words, by statistical Rov, by statistical probability. The Gemara says, I'm going to prove to you that even there, even by statistical probabilities, they also follow the Rov. So the Gemara says, how do we see that? From the case of a Katan Uktana. So the Gemara quotes the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that a Katan Uktana cannot do Chalitza or Yibam. So the Gemara explains that the Rabbanan respond to Rabbi Meir and says, well, it makes sense why a Katan cannot do Chalitza, because the Torah says the word Ish in the context of Chalitza, and the Gemara says we compare a woman to a man, and therefore, according to Rabbi Meir, both, and again, even according to the Rabbanan, everyone agrees that for Chalitza to occur, the man and the woman must be over Bar Bas Mitzvah. That's agreed upon by all. But the question is, why does Rabbi Meir say that even for Yibum, that the man or the woman have to be over Bar Bas Mitzvah? So the Gemara responds, right, in other words, Rabbi Meir says, well, because there's a chance that if the person is a Katan or the woman is a Katana, that maybe they're going to turn out to be a Sris or an Islandess. Right? In other words, they're going to be sterile, they're going to be barren, they're not going to be physically able to reproduce, and as we know, in those types of scenarios, if in fact the man was a Sris or the woman was an Islandess, there would not be a Mitzvah of Yibum, as we spoke a lot about earlier in the Masechta. The Mitzvah of Yibum would not apply in such a scenario. Now again, we don't know for a fact that this 10-year-old boy or girl is a Sris or an Islandess, but there's a chance, there's an outside chance that maybe they are. So Reb Meir says, well, we have to be concerned for that possibility, and if in fact it turns out to be true, they're going to end up violating the Isser of Eishasach, because Yibum will not apply in that scenario. So how did the Rabbanan deflect Rabbi Meir? The Rabbanan respond and say, yeah, but that's highly unlikely. It's highly improbable that this 10-year-old boy or girl is going to end up being a Sris or an Islandess, and therefore you should follow the Rov. So doesn't that point to, in other words, doesn't that lead us to believe that the Rabbanan hold that you follow the Rov even by statistical probability? In other words, this is not a thing that you can just count up and say, well, most men in the world are not Srisin, most women are not Islandesses. You can't count up people and say that. That's just a statistical probability. So the Gemara says, even so, the Rabbanan are still following the Rov, even though it's just a statistical probability. So the Gemara says, you're right. Therefore, you have to say what makes the most sense is to say that our Mishnah is reflecting Rabbi Meir. Again, Rabbi Meir is the position throughout Shas that's always concerned for the miut. Again, he doesn't distinguish between whether it's a rov or a miut you can count up, whether it's a statistical probability. Rabbi Meir always assumes that you have to be concerned for the miut, and therefore you cannot say that our Mishnah even follows the opinion of the Rabbana. So the Gemara then pushes back again. B'mayu kimta ki Rabbi Meir, ema seifa, ha'yisolach hamos ena chosheshes samai, ha'lecha ha'rov nashim, ve'rov nashim esabros v'yoldos, miut mapilos, v'chol ha'yoldos mechza scharim u'mechza nekevos, smoch miyuta de mapilos le'mechza nekevos, v'havu le'secharim miyuta v'lechosh. The Gemara says, hang on one second. If we're now going to assume that our Mishnah is attributed to Rabbi Meir, who's concerned for the miut, well, now we have to look at the latter part of the Mishnah, because remember, the Mishnah also told us that in the event that the husband goes overseas with his co-wife, so the Gemara said, the Mishnah said, well, if the mother-in-law is alive, so first the Mishnah said, you don't have to be concerned that maybe she had a child, maybe she had a boy, that now will obligate the woman in Yibum, but if she was pregnant, that was a machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehoshua, whether we have to assume that now she gave birth to a boy. But the question is, if our Mishnah is really reflecting the opinion of Rabbi Meir, well, why aren't we concerned that this woman actually, in other words, that the mother-in-law gave birth to a boy? Why, what would that concern be based on? So again, the Rove is, as we noted before in the Gemara, most women become pregnant and give birth. There's a minority of women who, even when they're pregnant, eventually have a miscarriage. And of the women who give birth, obviously, half are male, half are female. So the question is like this. According to Rabbi Meir, who's concerned for the miut, that we have to be concerned for this minority possibility that the woman, theoretically had a miscarriage. So let's take that minority possibility that the woman might have had a miscarriage, and let's, put that together with the 50% possibility that she had a girl. So therefore, in other words, the odds that this woman gave birth to a boy is a miut, But again, Rabbi Meir is the one who's concerned for the miut, so that should be problematic. If in fact our Mishnah really is being attributed to Rabbi Meir, let's be concerned in all cases that the mother-in-law gave birth to a baby boy. And again, even though it's not likely, but it's a miut, and Rabbi Meir is the one who's concerned for the miut. So the Gemara pushes back. The Gemara says no. Dilma kevan de ichazka lashuk lo chayesh. The Gemara says no. You can argue that since this woman at this stage has a presumption that she is allowed to marry whoever she wants, so now we can't now be concerned for this miut. Why does the woman have a presumption that she can marry whoever she wants? Because remember, in this scenario, her husband does not have a brother. We're trying to construct the case to say, well, maybe the mother-in-law gave birth to a boy and now there's going to be an obligation of Yibam. But at the stage when the husband left, he didn't have a brother. So at that point, there is no obligation of Yibam. And if it turns out the husband dies, she's free to marry whoever she wants because obviously there's no Yibam when there's no brother involved. So the Gemara says, you now want to try to override that presumption, override that chazaka, and say, well, maybe the mother-in-law had a baby. So then for that Mia, for that minority possibility, we're not going to override a previous chazaka. So the Gemara then asks, Reisha de ichazik liyibam tiyabim. But if that's true, that we're not going to override a chazaka based on a minority possibility, well, what about in the first case where there's a possibility of Yibum involved? Again, remember, in a scenario where there are no children and when there is a brother around, so the Mishnah also said that the woman is not allowed to do Yibum until she can clarify with 100% certainty whether the co-wife had a child. But the question is, why should that be so? In other words, at this stage, let's say it's an example where there are no children and there was a brother. The Mishnah said that the woman is still not allowed to do Yibum until we know for a fact whether or not the co-wife had a child. But again, the question is, why not? Why can't we just assume that in other words, why don't we say that she had a presumption that she was obligated in Yibam? We don't know for a fact that the co-wife had a child. There is a minority possibility that maybe she had a miscarriage, so let's say that she can do Yibam in that scenario. Again, according to Rabbi Meir. So the Gemara says, no. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Baravua, Reisha de Isra Karis Chashashu, Seifa de Isra Lavlo Chashashu. The Gemara says, no, there's a big difference between these two cases, because allowing a woman to marry her brother-in-law, not in the context of Yibam, is an Isra de Oraisa. It's a Chi of Kari. It's a very, very serious Isser. It's an Isser of Eshazach. We only do away with that Isser if it's done in the context of Yibam. In contrast, the prohibition against a woman getting married when she otherwise has an obligation of Yibam or Chalitza, just letting her marry somebody else, that's called Yivam al-Ashuk, that's just a regular lav. So since it's only a regular lav, right, that's the Pasuk in Parshas Kisesi, Lo Sihiyeh Eshaz HaMeis HaChutza Li'Ishzar. You can't just let a woman get married before she first does Yibam or Chalitza. So because that's just a regular lav, the Gemara says, therefore, we're not going to be as concerned. So the Gemara says, but hang on 1 second. Amar Rava, Michdi, Hador Reisav, Hador Reisav, Mali Isser Karis, Mali Isser. The Gemara says that's not a great answer. At the end of the day, they're still both Yisurei de Oraisa. So who cares? One's a Chi of Kareis, one's a regular Lav. You're still violating an Isurei de Oraisa, or theoretically violating an Isurei de Oraisa if you let her get remarried before figuring out whether she really needs Yibam or Chalitza. So the Gemara says, you're right. Ela Amar Rava, Reisha Chazaka liYibam veRuba Lashuk, vaChazaka lo Adiv kiRuba, vaAisei Miyuta de Mapilos Smoch laChazaka vaHavelei Palga uFalga, lo Sinasi veLo Ses Yabim, Seifa Chazaka Lashuk Veruba Lashuk, the Havale Zechare Miyuta Dimiyuta, Umiyuta Dimiyuta Lo Chayesh Rabbi Meir. Comes the Gemara with the following distinction. In the first case in the Mishnah, so the woman has a presumption that she's supposed to do Yibam. Again, she has no children at this point. Her husband went overseas and the husband has a brother. So the Gemara says at that stage, she has a presumption that she's required to do Yibam, but there's also a rove that's pointing in the direction that maybe she can outmarry whoever she wants without Yibam, because again, there's a very high probability that the co-wife actually had a child, which if that were true, she would now be allowed to marry whoever she wants. So the Gemara says, well, we have to do the math here. So the Gemara says that the chazaka, her previous presumption that she was obligated in Yibam, is not strong enough to override the rov, the high probability that the co-wife had a child, and therefore the Gemara says like this, we should take the minority possibility that the co-wife had a miscarriage, we should put that next to the woman's chazaka, her previous presumption that she was obligated in Yibam, and now we're kind of at an impasse. We're at a 50-50 standstill here, because on the one hand, you have the minority that maybe the co-wife miscarried with the previous presumption that the wife was obligated in Yibam, and you put that up against the rove that the co-wife probably had a child, and those two things are going to clash, and now you're stuck. So that's why the woman can't do Yibam, and she also can't remarry. On the other hand, in the latter case in the Mishnah, the Gemara says, the woman's initial presumption was that she was allowed to get married to whoever she wanted because her husband didn't have any brothers, and now you're trying to override that by claiming, well, maybe the mother-in-law gave birth to a boy. So the Gemara says, again, that's going to be, but that is a miut de miut. That's a double minority. Why is that a double minority? Because first of all, there's a possibility that the woman miscarried. And even if she didn't miscarry, maybe she gave birth to a girl, in which case, obviously, there's not going to be any yibum either. So the Gemara says that even Rabbi Meir, who normally is concerned for the miut, he's only concerned for one miut. He's not concerned for a double miut. So the Gemara says that's the nature of the distinction. It's not about the difference of a chi of kares versus a regular lav. That's just an arbitrary distinction. The distinction is that it's really one miut versus two, and that's why even Rabbi Meir is not going to be concerned for this double miut. Okay. Then the Mishnah said, Lo si nase velo si siyabim. The Mishnah said, in this type of scenario, where again, we don't know for a fact that if whether the co-wife had a child, so the Mishnah said that the woman is not allowed to marry anybody else, but she also can't do yibum until she clarifies what happened with the co-wife. So the Gemara asks, Uliola, is she going to be stuck like this forever? What if she never finds out whether the co-wife had a child? What's she supposed to do? So the Gemara says, no. Amar ze'iri, la'atzma shlosha chadashim, la'chaverta tisha, v'choletzes mimanav shach. So comes ze'iri and says that in terms of the woman herself, so as we've spoken about countless times in this Masechta, she needs to wait 3 months before getting remarried. The same way that any woman, after becoming widowed or divorced, we need to wait 3 months because of Havchana, because we want to make sure we know who the father of the child is. So the woman, in terms of herself, needs to wait 3 months before she marries anybody else. But in terms of her co-wife, she needs to wait 9 months in other words, in order to know for a fact whether the co-wife had a child. In other words, once the 9 months are up, either the co-wife had a child, in which case she's exempt from yibum anyway, or the co-wife did not have a child, in which case anyway she can do chalitza and exempt herself, and then she can go ahead and marry whoever she wants. So the Gemara then says that's according to Ze'iri. However, Rabbi Chanina Amar la'atzma shlosha la'chaverta li'olam. Rabbi Chanina disagrees. He says you're right in terms of the woman herself. Again, she has to wait those requisite 3 months in order that we know for a fact who the father is. But in terms of the co-wife, says Rabbi Chanina, you can never allow this woman to remarry or do yibum until you clarify whether the co-wife had a child. You can't just say, oh, after 9 months, everything's fine. You can't do that. But the Gemara asks, but why not? In other words, why don't we just do chalitza, as we noted before? If, in fact, it turned out that the woman had a child, you know, within the 9 months, so then the chalitza is meaningless because she can go marry whoever she wants anyway. And if it turned out that the woman, if the co-wife did not have a child, so then the chalitza anyway is going to release this woman and allow her to marry whoever she wants. Why is that not a viable option? So the Gemara says, no. Abaye Baravin, Rabbi Chanina Baravin, Amri Travayu, Gzeira Shema Yehev La Ben Kayama, V'nimtza Ata Matzricha Kruz LeKuhuna. The Gemara says that we're concerned for the following. If, let's say, it turned out that the co-wife, in fact, had a child, and this woman went through Chalitza Misafe because at the time she wasn't sure whether the co-wife had a child, what's going to happen is that people are going to think that the child is the product of a chalutza, and the child who's born from a chalutza is not allowed to marry a kohen. Now again, remember, this chalitza is not a real chalitza if it turned out that the co-wife actually had a child, because then chalitza was never really required. So the problem is that we're going to have to start making all these proclamations so that people know that, well, the chalitza was really a fake chalitza and the person's allowed to marry a kohen. We're afraid that people are going to get confused. So the Gemara says, okay, v'litzricha, so make the announcement.
Wouldn't the woman be more than happy to say, look, I'm going to get married? Because we always say a woman always wants to be married.
Yeah.
I just won't marry a Kohen. I mean, if that's the only chassad...
Well, yeah. Correct. In other words, the woman, of course, can say that. But the point is that if, let's say, I don't know, let's say she falls in love with the Kohen, she wants to marry the Kohen. So now the question becomes: Do we now have to be concerned that people are going to start to say, well, maybe, you know, she's a chalutza, she experienced chalitza, she's really not allowed to marry a Kohen. Again, you're right in theory. She just decides to marry a non Kohen. That's really not an issue. But here we're talking about a case where she wants to marry a Kohen, right? So the Gemara says, okay, so why can't we just make the proclamation and let everybody know that the chalitza was a fake chalitza because the co-wife had a child? So the Gemara says, no. Dilma ika da havi b'chalitza v'lo havi b'chrozav v'amri kasher chalutza l'chav. Again, we're afraid, you know, maybe there were people who were at the fake chalitza, but they weren't there for the proclamation, and they're going to come away with this mistaken impression that a chalutza can marry a kohen. So in order to avoid that potential pitfall, we say that in this type of scenario, you're not allowed to just do chalitza. In other words, you need to find out with 100% certainty, says Rabbi Chanina, whether the kohen had a child. You can't just say, oh, let's just do chalitza mimanav shach and call it a day, because if you do that, you may end up with this possibility that people are going to think that a chalutza can marry a kohen. Okay, then the Gemara says, Tanan, Nitin li ben b'medina sayam, v'amra meis b'ni v'acharkach ba'ali ne'emenes, meis ba'ali v'acharkach b'ni eina ne'emenes, v'choshishin lidvareha, v'choletzes v'lo misyabemes. So the Gemara says the following, right? This is a Mishnah back on yesterday's daf. The Mishnah said, let's say a woman comes back from a trip overseas, and she says that my husband and I gave birth to a baby boy while we were overseas, and then she says that my son died, and then my husband died, which is essentially another way of saying that she's required to do Yibum, right? In other words, because if she's claiming that her son died first and then her husband, so that means at the time her husband died, she didn't have any children. So the Gemara says, there we believe her. In that scenario, we believe her. But if she said the opposite, if she said that my husband died and then my son died, which is another way of saying that she's not required to do Yibum, so the Gemara says, then we don't believe her. But the Gemara says we believe her to a degree that we're going to require her to do chalitza misafik. So the Gemara then asks, "V'leichosh dilma asu edim va'amri kedika amra v'nimtza ata matzricha kruz l'kahuna." Based on the Gemara's concern in a previous case, why aren't we concerned that maybe edim will come along and corroborate her statement and say, "Yes, in fact, this woman, had a child overseas, and her son died, and then her husband, and then it's going to turn out that the whole chalitza was not really required, and then you're going to have to make this proclamation." I mean, maybe again people aren't going to be around for the proclamation, they're only for the chalitza, they're going to have that same concern that we had in the previous case. So the Gemara says no. Amar of Papa Begrusha. So one answer in the Gemara is that the woman that we're dealing with here was already a divorcee from a previous marriage. So if she's a Grusha, then everyone knows that she can't marry a Kohen anyway. So in this scenario, you're not going to need to make any sort of declaration. Then the Gemara says a second answer, Rechia Bere de Ravuna Amar, but Amra Anivahu Nechbeinu Bama'ara. A second possibility is where she says that my husband and I were hiding away in a cave, which is another way of saying there was no one else there. There were no other witnesses who saw what happened, so I'm the only one. So if witnesses come, they're obviously lying. So again, in these specific scenarios, so then we can rely on her words, at least misafek. But the Gemara says, you're right, if Edom end up coming and it's just a normal case and they and end up blowing the case open and they say, yeah, this is in fact true, so then we do have that theoretical concern that people are going to conflate the halachos of a chalutza marriage code. Okay, says the Mishnah, Shtei yuvamos, zo meris meis ba'ali, v'zo meris meis ba'ali, zo asura mipnei ba'ila shel zo, v'zo asura mipnei ba'ila shel zo. It's a very strange case here. So you have two women who are sisters-in-law, right? Again, they married two brothers, and each of them are claiming that their husbands died. Now, as we've spoken about already many times before, when a woman claims that her husband died under normal scenarios, again, leaving aside all the cases we mentioned in the last paragraph about war and famine, all those things, but in a normal case, we typically believe her. Now, again, whether we really believe her, or we think that she did her homework, and she's not going to want to ruin her theoretical marriage prospects in the future, but again, whatever the pshat is that we typically believe the woman in terms of herself, but we don't necessarily believe her in terms of other people. So now you have this strange case where we're believing the women to say for themselves that their husbands died, but the problem is we don't believe that vis-a-vis the sister-in-law. So in other words, there's no way of saying that basically we assume that they're now widowed, but we also have this concern that, well, maybe the brother-in-law is actually still alive, which means that they're kind of stuck now because maybe they do in fact have an obligation of yibum or chalitza. So the Gemara says what's going to happen basically is that they're both going to become asura until we can prove whether the brothers-in-law actually died. Then the Mishnah continues, Lazo Edim belazo ein edim, as sheyesh la edim asura, as she'ein la edim mutera. So let's say only one of the women has edim that corroborate the fact that her husband died. So the one who has the edim, it's actually going to be worse for her because her brother-in-law is the one who doesn't have edim. So she has to be concerned that he's still alive. But whereas the one without the edim, so the edim are testifying that her brother-in-law died. So that means she's free to go. That means that she's able to go marry whoever she wants. And again, we also believe her insofar as herself, that her husband died, just not regarding her sister-in-law. Then the Mishnah says, Lazo banim belazo ein banim, as she'esh labanim muteres, ves she'ein labanim asura. If, let's say, one of the women had children and the other one did not, so again, the one with children is obviously exempt from yibum anyway because she has children, the one without, so she is still going to be stuck, she's going to be asura, until we can clarify whether her brother-in-law actually died. Then the Mishnah says, Nisyabimu v'mesu hayavamin, asuros lihinase, Rabbi Elazar omer ho v'hutshu liyavamin, hutshu l'chola. And the Mishnah has a further machlokas. Let's say these women went ahead and they did Yibum with, let's say, two other brothers, and then those two brothers both died childless. So now the question is, are they allowed to now get remarried, or do we still have to have that concern in the back of our heads that maybe their original husbands are still alive? So the Mishnah says that according to the Tanakhama, yes, they're not allowed to get remarried until we can prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that the original husbands, the original brothers-in-law died. But according to Rabbi Elazar, he says, no, once you're permitting them to do Yibum, so now you have to allow them to marry whoever they want. Okay, so the Gemara explains, Tana, lazo edim ubanim, velazo lo edim velo banim, shtei an mutaros. The Gemara almost adds another case to our Mishnah, where it says, let's say one of the women had edim, that her husband died, and also had children of her own, and the other one had no edim, and also had no children, so then strangely, the Mishnah says that both of them are now permitted to get remarried. Then the Gemara says, nisyabimu v'mesu hayavam en asurim lihinase, Rabbi Elazar omer ho v'hutru leivam en hutru l'chodim. That was the machlokas at the end of the Mishnah, where according to the Tanakhama, if the two brothers-in-law, in other words, if the two other brothers that they marry die childless, so, and again, we're still not 100% sure about the original husbands because we don't believe the women insofar as the other one. So according to the Tanna Kamma, they're not allowed to get remarried until we know 100% certainty whether their husbands actually died. But according to Rabbi Elazar, once you permit them to do Yibam, you can now allow them to marry whoever they want. So the Gemara then asks, Boy Rava, my time with the Rabbi Elazar. What's the logic behind Rabbi Elazar? In other words, why is it that once we allow them to do Yibam, we can now allow them to marry whoever they want? So the Gemara explains, the Gemara offers one of two possibilities. Either there's an objective standard, there's an objective halacha that a woman is allowed to testify about her co-wife, about the other wife. So if that were the case, so she can testify that the other one died, and in other words, maybe Rabbi Elazar just disagrees with the entire premise of our Mishnah. We thought that the woman is only believed regarding herself to say that her own husband died, but not regarding the other wife. So Rabbi Elazar maybe disagrees with that. Maybe he says that it's not true. Maybe the women are believed to testify about the other one. Or the other possibility is that, no, maybe they're not intrinsically believed, but the woman has a lot to lose here. Because if it turns out that she's lying, her husband is actually alive, she's going to end up violating Losinaf, and there may be Mamzerim down the line. So the Gemara says that since the woman is not willing to corrupt her future prospects in terms of children, in terms of her own marriage prospects, so the same way that she is going to be 100% certain that her husband died, so we would therefore believe her regarding the other one. But it doesn't mean that she has intrinsic credibility. So the Gemara asks, Lemay Naf, what's the difference between these two approaches? The Gemara says the nafkamina would be whether the co-wife can get married before the woman herself. If you think that the wife has intrinsic credibility to testify about her co-wife, then it shouldn't make a difference whether the original wife got married yet or not. But if you think that the only reason why we believe the wife to testify about the other wife is because she's not going to want to ruin her own marriage prospects and potentially have children who are mamzerim, so the only way you can possibly believe her is if she actually bit the bullet and got remarried, because that would actually lend credence to her claim. Whereas if she just is, you know, claiming, well, yeah, my husband died, but she herself doesn't act on it and get remarried, so that's a pretty good indication that maybe she doesn't actually believe it. So the Gemara says, "My, what's the din here?" Tashma, Rabbi Elazar Omer, ho the huchu layavam and huchu lecholadim. That was what Rabbi Elazar said in the Mishnah. In other words, once you're allowing them to do yibam, and then when those brothers eventually die, so you're going to let them marry whoever they want. So the Gemara explains, "I amar pishlama dehila mekalkula nafsha haynu dechi insiv menasvinan la ela I amar mishum detzara meida lachaverta afal gav de lo insiv nami." The Gemara says, "I understand if you think like the second approach, that the only reason why the woman is believed to testify about her co-wife is because she's not going to want to ruin her own shidduch prospects, right? So that's why we say if she gets married, then yes, we believe her. But if not, then not. But if you're going to think that there's an objective standard that we always believe a wife to testify about the co-wife, so then it shouldn't matter whether she gets married or not." So the Gemara says, "You're right. So it must be, therefore," says the Gemara, "that the only reason why we believe her according to Rabbi Elazar is because she herself got remarried and she's not going to want to ruin herself." So the Gemara says, "No, it's not true. Rabbi Elazar ledivrem kamar lehu lididi tsara meida lachaverta viatha gav de la insiv minasvinan la ela lididhu odu li mias tehicha de insiv minasvinan la mishum dehila mekalkala nafsha." Rabbi Elazar turns to the Rabbanan and says as follows. He says that according to me, I think that the woman is always believed to testify about her co-wife no matter what, that she has objective credibility. But even according to you, the Rabbanan, who think that it's about, you know, taking down the co-wife, so at least admit to me that when the woman gets remarried, we should at least believe her vis-a-vis the co-wife. To which the Rabbanan say, "No, for Rabbanan, tamos nashi implishtim hu dekaavda." The Rabbanan say, "No, she's following the paradigm in Sefer Shoftim where Shimshon says, I'm gonna get myself killed in order to kill the plishtim." In other words, the woman apparently is willing to say, "I'm willing to sink myself as long as I take the co-wife down with me." So it's not 100% guaranteed, even if the woman herself gets remarried, that she's necessarily looking out for her best interest. She might just be trying to mess over the co-wife. And then we'll just finish up with this last part of the Gemara. The Gemara says, "Tashma ha'isha sheholcha hi uvayla lemedina sayam uva v'amra meis ba'ali tinase v'sitol ksubasa vitzarasa asura." So again, this goes back to the Mishnah, right? If the woman goes overseas with her husband, and then she comes back and she says that my husband died, so she can get remarried and she's entitled to take her ksuba. However, the co-wife is forbidden to get remarried because, again, as we pointed out in the Gemara before, we believe her vis-a-vis herself, but not in terms of the co-wife. However, Rabbi Elazar Omer, ho ova hutra hi, hutra nami tsarasa, whereas Rabbi Elazar says, no, that since we believe her, right, so in other words, we're going to allow the co-wife to get remarried as well. So the Gemara says, no, ema ho ova hutra v'niseis. In other words, the Gemara says, the only reason why we let the co-wife get remarried is because the woman herself got remarried, as we noted in the Gemara earlier. So the Gemara then asks, "V'leichosh Dilma begite asai v'hayde kamrachi lekalkala letzarihi mechavna." So the Gemara says, "Well, maybe we have to be concerned for the following. Maybe the woman is coming to us with a get, and she's claiming that she was actually divorced, and that which she's saying that her husband died, she's just trying to mess over her co-wife, as we noted in the Gemara earlier, and that's why she's claiming that her husband died." In other words, the woman herself already has an out. She has a get. She's already been released from the marriage, but she's making up a story that her husband died in order that her co-wife gets remarried, and it turns out that the husband was still alive. So the Gemara says, "You're right." The Gemara says that would be true. That concern would be valid if she was married to a Yisrael, because a Yisrael, of course, can marry a Grusha. But if she was married to a Kohen, if she comes to us with a get, she's essentially forbidding herself too. So she's not helping her own case by admitting that she was divorced. So in that scenario, we would still believe her if she was in fact married to a Kohen.